Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody, what's going on? Let's get it done. It's David Summers. Here comes another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring and back into time as we get wall-to-wall and tree-top tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Okay, Ron, I'm pretty sure you've already had your Count Chocula, your Frosted Flakes, whatever. You ready to go for the day?
Oh, yeah, man. I'm geared up. Looking forward to it. We got a good one here, I think.
Good deal. Listen, I'm sure a lot of people don't realize how much time, how much research you put into these studcasts. So how long does it take? I mean, because you got a great big brain and a good one, but there's no way that one person can remember all of this information, like who was in what match and how many matches way back in 1980, et cetera. So you spend a tremendous amount of research on all of this.
Oh, yeah, I really do, man. I actually spend probably, I'd say 20, maybe 30 hours.
Wow.
Going back and finding all the information and trying to get as much as I can, and then jogging my memory as much as I can, and you know it's time well spent. I really enjoy it, especially once I get the finished product and I go, wow, man, this I think fans are going to really appreciate that. And obviously we've got a lot of them, and I think they do really appreciate it. And
yeah, you also
a good one today, as a matter of fact, too, Dave. We're going into a good time frame in 1980, in which we were getting a lot of junior heavyweights, great junior heavyweights coming into the territory, and so we got a whole lot of other information, obviously, as well. But
yeah,
wow, 1980 June of 1980 was good time for Southeastern. The company was really exploding.
Listen, you've once said how many matches you've done over the years, and it would be absolutely impossible for you to remember every match. So it's amazing to me how you're able to get the information and bring it back to us, and the memories that must jog for you as to where you were on a certain date, and a lot of stuff starts coming back. Is that kind of how you feel it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and the chart, the big chart that I have that the two guys did for me years ago that gives me every match I did, not everyone, because they couldn't got them all, but thousands and thousands of matches. And, you know, when I look back and try to find out where I was on a certain day or a certain time frame, and oh, boy, it's a really a heck of a ride, man, going back in time and seeing who are some of the people I was wrestling in those days.
That's awesome. All right, so listen, the history of Southeastern wrestling is flowing like the Chattahoochee River, and everybody knows that thing flows fast. All right, so you're now returning to doing studcasts that cover Southeastern Knoxville and their card, plus an all-star card from the Knoxville area, and then the Southeastern Gulf Coast card. So basically, the cards not only from the Knoxville territory, but you also cover the card, the TV show, the match results and attendances for the Gulf Coast territory. That's a big load, but man, you do an amazing job handling it.
Well, yeah. Well, I think I'm doing my best, the best I can. But you know, that was the plan there, basically, today, Dave. But my good friend Ed Harrison, who lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and helps me. He's one of the guys that gets me all these cards and gives me so much information because he's a wrestling historian. And after doing the research for me, found out that the Knoxville Five, the all-star card that we were going to do in this show today, didn't happen at all. And actually, the last Studcast that we did the all-star card, that was the very last card and matches they ever did in Knoxville. So it's quite a coincidence, man. They ran their first card there on Saturday, June the 9th, 1979. And then they ran their last card almost exactly to the day a year later in 1980.
Wow.
So three of the original Knoxville Five, the five wrestlers that left Southeastern, that formed their own company, had long since left the area by this point. And so those were, and those three guys were the ones that left were Ron Wright, Bob Roop, and Great Malenko. Mm-hmm. Ron Wright didn't leave. He lived up there in the Tri-Cities.
Yeah.
So he didn't go anywhere. But Roop and Malenko, they kind of left those other guys. And they went out basically back to wrestling for other companies. So the other two, Ronnie Garvin and Bob Orton Jr., they had kind of joined forces with the Angelo Poffo family up there in Kentucky. And that's the ICW, International Championship Wrestling, I assume, mm-hmm. is what the ICW stood for. But Angelo Poffo had two sons, Lanny and Randy. And obviously, Randy became known as the Macho Man, Randy Savage.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. And I've heard some say that, you know, Garvin and Orton Jr., they got probably a small percentage of the Poffo's company up there after they left Knoxville, after they quit coming to Knoxville. So basically, we're not going to be doing, I don't think, all-star cards in the Knoxville area anymore because there was no more all-star there.
Yeah, it just didn't stand up as long as what they had predicted, maybe. All right, so the All-Star Wrestling Company, it closed down in Knoxville after just 1 year of trying to beat Southeastern.
Yeah, that's basically it. I think they went as far as they could. And obviously, we talked about in the last show, they were running matches in a field somewhere. That was the name of it anyway. So, you know, they had changed venues probably four or five times. And crowds, I can't imagine how small their crowds were for them to have to quit and leave. But that was what's the end of it. So that's what happened. And I still owned Southeastern for the first 5 months of that first year that they were in business. And All-Star Wrestling operated before I sold the territory to the Georgia promoters, to Jim Barnett and Fred Ward. And we will, you know, still discuss the new company's problems. Barnett and Fred Ward, they're still there. And we'll be making, you know, successful. They were going to try to make Southeastern successful again, and we'll talk about all the problems that they had. And in this Studcast, we're going to be talking about their card, their actual card on Friday night, June the 13th, 1980. It's in the same week as the Southeastern Gulf Coast card that we're going to talk about later in the podcast.
All right, speaking of what we're going to be talking about today, where are we riding this week? How do you get this thing going?
Well, our hidden history lesson today is going to be about booking. And specifically, we're going to be talking about the Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory in the month of June 1980, when we were suddenly almost, if you can imagine that, and it was very rare, we were almost too full of great talent. We had so many good wrestlers that wanted to get in there, and we had promised them that we would get them there. We were running into almost a problem with having too much talent. And so we had to resort to something that was not normally done. So we're going to discuss basically why, when, and how to turn a wrestler from a heel to a babyface and vice versa, because we're going to get into that situation here where we're going to have to make some changes. So we will also be discussing another great card in the Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory. We'll be talking about the third week of June, 1980. We'll talk about the TV that promoted the card like we always do, the results of the matches, and the attendances in the three major cities in the territory. And hopefully also we're going to have a learning tree question at the end of the studcast.
All right, good deal. So, I mean, it sounds obviously like it's another loaded studcast, Ron. All right, all kinds of history. So where do we start and where do we go first?
Well, since there was an all-star company, no all-star company anymore in Knoxville, let's begin with the Southeastern card, which was in the same week as we're going to be discussing later in the show down there in the Gulf Coast. So we'll begin with the new Southeastern promoters Friday night card on June 13th, 1980. The main event the week before was a cage match, a loser leaves match between a guy named Steve Travis and Dutch Mantell. And Dutch must have won the match because he was on this new card. Obviously, Steve Travis was not on the new card, so he lost that cage match. So Dutch Mantell was on the new card. He was in the main event again, and it was a Boston street fight between Kevin Sullivan and Dutch Mantell. And both of those guys were thankfully recognizable to Tennessee fans. They weren't guys that came from the Georgia territory up there. Kevin had been there a long time at that point. Dutch had been there for me years earlier. So the next match on that card was for the Southeastern Championship. A guy named Bad News Harris versus Terry Taylor. Now, I don't know who the champion was because I got ads sent to me by, I've already mentioned, Ed Harrison sent me ads for this show. And in the ad, it didn't say which one of these two guys were the champion. So I also didn't personally know either one of these two wrestlers. So this is an example of the Georgia territory sending in guys that are not known to the Knoxville fans. Next match was a special tag match. Austin Idol and Kevin Sullivan versus Dutch Mantell and Dennis Connery. And man, if that don't sound strange, I have no idea why the two guys that were in the main event, Dutch Mantell and Kevin Sullivan, are in a tag team match first in the night. So now what can be special about that?
Wow. I wonder if they got paid double for that.
No, I'm pretty sure they probably didn't.
All right, that's crazy. Are you kidding? They were in a tag match just two matches before coming back together against each other in a Boston street fight?
Yes. Sorry, man. I can't really explain that, to be honest with you. So then for the, there was going to be a Southeastern Tag Championship match. Randy Mountaineer and guy named Troy T. Tyler was facing who I seemed to be, like they said, they didn't have it in the ad, who was the champions. But I assumed that the Manchurians were the champions. They were managed by the great Mephisto. And of these five guys, the only one of the five I know and then I recognize is Mephisto, who wrestled for me there in 1976. So the ad said, plus one more match, besides the ones that I had just mentioned. So that would mean this card only had five matches on it. And as usual, a lot of them are unrecognizable to Knoxville fans. So in the last studcast, we talked about some of the negative things that were being done in the territory during this time frame. And immediately following the sale of the territory in October of 1979, just as soon as I finished selling it, my first question to Jim Barnett was, how many of my present crew did he want to keep there? Gave him the opportunity. I had some great talent there to pick and choose whoever he wanted. And he only kept four of them, and two of them I thought were the worst guys in the crew. I was like, wow, why would he pick those two guys and only take four out of the entire crew? Because obviously these wrestlers were over. People knew who they were at least. So they also warned Barnett at that time not to give the fans less than six matches, and that at most times But we had grown so big that we were given the fans 7 matches. So here was a 5-match card, which obviously meant that that he hadn't listened to my suggestion, and now it was going to come back to haunt him.
Yeah, it seems like in a big way. All right, I remember you're discussing who he wanted to keep from your crew before you left Tennessee. I also remember on the last card that he had 6 matches. I think that's correct. So why would he not have paid more attention to you? Because obviously you were very successful over a pretty good period of time there.
Well, you know, I think it's because Jim considered himself one of the sharpest minds in the wrestling business. And he had been in the business for more than 40 years at this point. And I had only been an owner for 5 years. Even if I did have 2 territories, I was still only 5 years experience as an owner. Jim Barnett also had a huge ego. And so my suggestions went, I think, in one ear and out the other. And I think he expected within the first 6 months of operation that he was going to be filling every building in the territory like I was doing. And, you know, and if not better, he probably figured that I'm going to be, this thing is just going to blow up and get huge. And wow, he had no doubt that he was going to be successful, I don't believe.
Okay, I have to say that in the broadcasting industry, I've definitely met some people like that. You can't tell me. You can't. Okay. You just let it fail. Good luck. All right, so with the All-Star Company gone, what did he do to try and get those fans to come back to Southeastern?
Well, you would think at this point that's he had been that since the award started, they've been having matches every week. Now this company is kaput. It's gone. So he's got that fan base, whatever it is, and I think it was probably only about 25% of our normal crowds left and went to All-Star when we started the war. And so before they opened up, it made a difference. That 25% made a difference basically in breaking even or making a profit on each event. So I remember I asked Les Thatcher, what did he do? What did Barnett do to try to get those old fans back? Mm-hmm. I was curious. So, they closed down. What did Barnett do to make a play to get these people to come back? And he said Jim Barnett never made any attempt to get them back.
Wow. No wonder they were in trouble. All right, so are you ready for this week's hidden history lesson about when, why, and how to turn a wrestler from heel to babyface and vice versa? I think that's going to be cool.
Yeah, I am. And something that this is all about something that was happening in the Southeastern Gulf Coast. It's the reason I wanted to talk about this today. Obviously, switching wrestlers from heels to babyface was definitely hidden history. We talked to fans about that, never discussed that with anybody that wasn't involved in the wrestling business or somebody that didn't know anything about the business. So we had a rare situation occurring in our territory in June of 1980. We were entering a period where we were adding talent quickly, and that explains the win part of needing to switch wrestlers' identities. We had 5 junior heavyweight wrestlers in the territory in the second week of June, 1980. We had Tony Charles, we had Jerry Stubbs, we had Norvell Austin, we had Roy Lee Welch, we had Randy Rhodes. Who could be used in that category if we wanted to? Randy Rhodes was the size of a junior heavyweight. And 3 of those were babyfaces and 2 of those were heels. Then we had 2 more coming in the next 2 weeks, junior babyfaces, and great ones at that. Both were babyfaces. You had Ricky Gibson, and we had Sweet Brown Sugar, and both of them were also great workers. Besides, Gibson, that's his home, and we added them, and we were to give us 5 babyfaces and That would make us have five baby faces and two heel junior heavyweights. Now, you know, that was a real unlevel position there. And when you started booking people, that really created a problem. So we had to make some changes real fast. So you couldn't have a babyface junior heavyweight match on every card. It was fans enjoyed those clean matches every once in a while to a certain extent, but we certainly didn't want to lose the fans' interest because you're going to have one of those every night. Mm-hmm. So, so that's where the why you changed. Why would you change talent from a babyface to a heel or vice versa? So we're in this position where we got five babyfaces and two heel junior heavyweights. And if you did want to switch a wrestler, you had to make it perfect. It had to make sense to the fans. And if it didn't make sense, you could easily kill off one of your best wrestlers. If a switch was done correctly, you could take a hot guy and make him even hotter. But if it was done poorly, the wrestler, man, could lose his whole impact for you completely. He'd be worthless to you. You had to let him go, basically, because he didn't mean anything anymore. So we're taking a chance here at this point in time because we're going to switch some guys. So Sweet Brown Sugar was the first new junior heavyweight to make his debut on the card. And he's going to be on this card that we'll be talking about later in the show. And he was a great babyface, but we were overloaded with him at this point, you know, and he had never been a heel in his life. But when I talked to him about it before he came in, he was really intrigued with the idea, you know, and having worked and myself as both babyface and heel in my career, I learned going both ways makes you a much better wrestler. I mean, when you learn to be a heel and you could be a babyface too, you were a better talent because you could go any direction. So the last of these new junior heavyweights that were coming in was Ricky Gibson. And he's going to be on the next card that we'll be talking about in the next studcast. And Ricky was born and raised in Pensacola, which was the home of Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory. So he was a homeboy for sure, very popular. They knew him. They had never seen Sweet Bound Sugar. So that's kind of giving the fans an idea of where we were at this point. So, and we weren't planning on using Randy Rose, basically, as a junior heavyweight. So we kind of discounted him, pulled him out of that group. We also didn't use Roy in the ring very much at that time, because Roy was busy recording the matches that we were using on the TV shows. And Roy was using we had a tremendous camera. Wow. And we spent a lot of money on getting a first-class camera so that we could get great house show, big house events, get matches from there, and show them back on TV. So we would, by the following week, have five fantastic junior heavyweights in the territory. Tony Charles, Jerry Stubbs, Norvell Austin, Sweet Brown Sugar, and Ricky Gibson. That is a group of five talented dudes, man, as junior heavyweights. So in the next 3 weeks, we're going to blow the minds of the fans. Rob and I sit and talked about what we're going to do, and we were going to blow the minds of the fans, especially in the junior heavyweight matches that were upcoming.
Wow, I've never really heard you explain anything like that before. There must have been something special coming on the next Southeastern card. So before the break, why don't you set us up with that card for the third week of June in 1980? Take us back in time.
Right. The opening match was a real mismatch, to put it bluntly. There was a difference of 200 pounds in weight alone. In the two opponents, Roy Lee Welch was facing the monster, 6'10", 430-pound Plowboy Frazier, who had his valet Floyd with him, standing in his corner. So, wow, what a mismatch that was. After a 30-minute time limit draw between the two of them the week before, Jerry Stubbs was wrestling Norvell Austin in a no-time limit match. They had wrestled the week before. They expired a 30-minute time limit, was no winner. And the winner of that match was supposed to be getting a match against Tony Charles for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship. but there was no winner. So they're coming back and wrestling in a basically a no time limit match that had to have a winner, so that they would get one of them was going to get the shot at the champion. So on this card for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, we had a new guy coming in. And that new guy was going to be Sweet Brown Sugar. His very first night in the territory, he's going to be wrestling Tony Charles for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship. Then in the Southeastern Championship match, the Mongolian champion, managed by the Big C, was meeting Charlie Cook, who was very much entitled to having a championship match. And then for the Southeastern Tag Championship, the champions Randy Rose and Dr. Bill Irwin, managed by Big C, were defending against me and my brother. And they had had one of these matches, and the loser of the fall was going to have to leave Southeastern. And they'd had one of these matches the week before, and that's where Eddie Boulder had to get had to leave Southeastern. So we're having another one of these loser of the fall leave Southeastern championship tag matches. And then in the last match of the card, it was finally time, man, for the bull rope match. Big Ron Bass had been bringing out his rope and, you know, bragging about it. And so finally, Big Ron Bass is going to be managed by Big C, and he's going to be going up against Bob Armstrong in a bull rope match.
Man, I got to tell you, that's a really fantastic card. It looks like to me this one has five main events. All right, so when we come back after the break, we're going to take a look at what should be a tremendous TV show that promotes and sets up that card you just set up for us. That is coming up when this Studcast continues. All right, on the break today, we've got great news and big news for Alabama wrestling fans. Ron is returning to the Ozark Civic Center, Ozark, Alabama, Friday night, July 12, 2024. It's another great night of wrestling. Doors will open at 6 p.m. Matches begin at 7 p.m. Ron's going to be there to welcome fans when the doors open with all kinds of souvenirs. 8x10 glossy photos, Southeastern t-shirts, his classic thriller novel, Brutus, his beautiful USA Championship belt, which you can have a selfie made with, or with Ron for only $5. Some other Southeastern wrestling stars are going to be there as well, including Scott Armstrong. And don't miss the national anthem being sung by Jerome Jackson, a.k.a. Elvis. It's a great night of wrestling entertainment. Friday night, July 12th, 2024. Be there. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back in. As we get into the second half of this Studcast, it is time for us to find out what you did, Ron, to promote the upcoming card that you just gave us. How did this TV show start? Set that up for us.
Well, the TV show opened with the Big C and the Southeastern champion, Mongolian Stomper. They were joining Charlie Platt at the set. They watched the end of the match from 4 days earlier, where I was wrestling against the Stomper for the Southeastern championship and trying to get that belt again. The Big C never made a comment about the match while it was going on, other than he complained that about his being barred from ringside by Commissioner Don Curtis for that match. Didn't want to say what he saw on the ring because the Stomper was getting his butt kicked. And at the end of the match, when the Stomper threw me over the top rope on purpose to get himself disqualified, basically, because there's no Big C to help him out there, and he was in a position where I think I was going to be able to beat him for the belt for this one. And, you know, so Big C's, he finally jumps in to watch a little bit of the match, and he says, he says, look how clumsy he is. He fell over the top rope, he said about me, on purpose, you know, to get his hand raised. Because, you know, without that, he's had no way to ever beat my champion for the belt. So that was typical of Big C.
All right. So how about the first match? Let's go there.
Well, Charlie Cook was in the match, in this first match, because he's going to be wrestling the Stomper. And the Stomper and Big C are there at the set already. So it, you know, made sense to have Cook could do it. Going in the first match, and he got a much-deserved shot, basically, at the Stomper's belt. And so Big C verbally tore into him right away, man, as the studio crowd was giving Cook a big hand. Charlie Platt invited Big C and the Stomper to remain at set with him for comments about this match, you know. But, Big C, you know, he basically said, you know, he's just a former football star. And he said he should have kept playing football because he certainly ain't going to beat my champion. You know, he's got no chance. So Charlie Cook, you know, he kind of watched him get up and leave the set because, when Charlie said, would you like to stay here with us, with me and commentate over this match? And so Big C says, absolutely not. He's got no chance. I mean, why would I want to waste my time? So, you know, when he started leaving, Charlie got upset. Charlie Cook recognized that, hey, why would they leave the set? You know, and of course he couldn't hear what was being said about him, but I think he picked up on the fact that he had been insulted big time right before he went to the ring, and it really fired him up. And boy, he didn't take long, man, to definitely prove that he deserved the championship match. He won his match with a headbutt. With a headbutt that knocked his opponent unconscious. He knocked the guy out when he hit him with the headbutt at the end of the match. He was serious about this championship event.
No doubt. All right, who was next?
Well, the Big C returned again to the set. This time he had his tag team champions with him, Randy Rose, Dr. Bill Irwin. This time, Big C was happy to be there. He was more than happy to do some talking now. And he was eager for everyone to see the video. We had another video of his team beating, he called him Dizzy Eddie Boulder. That's his first time he'd used that name. Boulder lost the match to his team, and he called him Dizzy Eddie Boulder. And he said, we sent him packing, man, out of Southeastern Wrestling. You're not going to see him anymore. And then he was also happy that his team was defending against the Fullers, he said. And he said, because we're going to be able now to send one of the Fullers out of Southeastern, just like we did Boulder. So Big C bragged at Dizzy Eddie this week. He said, you know, well, look at that. Talking to his team, he says, we got rid of Dizzy Eddie this week, and the next week we're going to get one of the Fuller brothers gone.
All right, so how about the next match?
Well, that was Rob and I. You know, we're wrestling these guys. They're at the set. So, you know, and it had been 5 weeks since I had tagged up with Rob. He had been wrestling partners with Eddie Boulder for 5 weeks, wrestling basically these same two guys. And so when we went to the ring, we got a really good hand from the studio crowd. And Big C was turning down Charlie's invitation to stay and watch our tag team match, just like he had done with the Stomper. And when they passed by the ring, Rob and I, you know, we'd heard the interview, the opening, where he was making this big deal about, you know, getting rid of one of the Fullers. So we got the studio audience involved with us. We started waving goodbye. One of your guys are gone, right? We were saying as they're walking past us, going to the dresser, and the fans in the studio, they picked on it. Goodbye, goodbye. They were waving at him. So, the Big C didn't expect that to happen. He didn't like it either. So we quickly, as soon as they rang the bell, man, we kicked some butt in the TV match. And then we went, into the bleachers with the fans. We had a little celebration with the fans after that match.
That's cool. Okay, so to me, not a match, but one of the most pivotal moments in the TV shows back in the day, the personality profile, it seemed like that was where everything really broke loose.
Yeah, well, this one was with Tony Charles again. And we had Tony on last week, and it was another great profile. And we didn't do this very often, have the same guy on 2 weeks in a row for the profile. But it was an opportunity to tell fans what we talked about earlier, this basically a fast-changing landscape of junior heavyweights. It was like an invasion of the Southeastern territory. All of a sudden, we've got so many great junior heavyweights in the territory. And Tony was obviously the champion, the United States junior heavyweight champion. And if you're going to talk junior heavyweights, put him out there again. And, you know, we had plenty to talk about, that was for sure. So Charlie and Tony, who was the United States champion, discussed Southeastern's soon to be at this point five of the best junior heavyweight wrestlers in the world. And that wasn't counting Tony himself. So then they watched the video from Tony's next challenger, Sweet Brown Sugar, someone neither he nor Charlie knew anything about. You know, Brown Sugar had not been there before, so they were like, wow. So Brown Sugar had been wrestling out there in the Kansas City territory, and after I had that discussion with him about turning him heel, he kind of got into it, you know, because he had never done it in his career before. So you couldn't tell that he was not a heel for many, many years after watching this video. And I was back there in the dressing room, and obviously all the other baby faces are standing watching the monitor. And he not only blew my mind, but he blew everyone in the TV station's dressing room mind. They went like, son of a gun, man, what a heel he is. Well, look what he's doing. So my good friend, former NWA world champion Pat O'Connor, and the future NWA president Bob Geigel, I had talked to both of them because I'd been working out there in St. Louis for many years. I was real close with Pat and also close with Bob Geigel. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, take some time, spend a little time working with Sweet Brown Sugar because I'm going to turn him heel here. And so this was his very first shot at the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, Tony Charles, on his very first night in the territory.
Wow.
And the interview had barely finished before Norvell Austin suddenly appeared on the profile set. Wasn't supposed to be there. And he was extremely upset, mad at the Southeastern Commissioner, Don Curtis, for not only allowing this video to be made, but worse still, to bring this guy into the Southeastern territory. So, I wasn't aware that there was heat between Norvell Austin and Sweet Brown Sugar. So then Norvell didn't have a whole lot more to say because what's going on here, Charlie Platt? Doesn't Don Curtis know the story of Sweet Brown Sugar? What's he doing here? So he asked, first of all, I should be getting the shot at the champion, and certainly not this guy. He goes, this guy almost killed me 2 years ago. And he didn't tell the story. He just said, Brown Sugar almost killed me 2 years ago.
Wow.
So then he asked, after, why didn't I get the shot at the champion? He said he didn't care for Tony Charles. He said, I don't like you, Tony Charles, and he says, I got news for you. You need to look out for this guy, he said, Sweet Brown Sugar, he's a backstabbing, no good excuse for a human being. Mm-hmm. He was all fired up, man. And he said, and that's all I got to say. And he just turned around and left the set.
Wow. Okay. All right. I can't remember anybody interrupting a personality profile. So he must have been really fired up.
Well, that's what Charlie and Tony were asking each other, man. Like, whoa, what was that all about? And Norvell had just opened basically Pandora's box here. Mm-hmm. For all these junior heavyweight, the junior heavyweight championship race was about to take off. And it was never going to be the same again in the territory. We had these five guys, and they're going to be the stars, as big as the big boys, for weeks and weeks at this point. So Southeastern fans were about to take a wild ride, all built around the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship belt.
Wow. Okay. So what is it about the personality profile that is so good lately? This one is still kind of a real mystery. I can't wait to hear more about Pandora's box. Who is it? So who is in the next TV segment?
Well, Jerry Stubbs was at the set with Charlie, and they watched the last 3 minutes of a very exciting 30-minute time limit draw match. Like I said, Stubbs and Norvell, the winner was supposed to get the shot at Tony Charles. but it was only a 30-minute time limit, and the match went to a draw. And so, in the coming week, instead of either one of them getting that shot at him, in comes Sweet Brown Sugar that nobody's ever seen, and he's going to get the shot at the champion. So Stubbs was just as upset as Norvell about what was going on. He's like, wait a minute. Well, I should have been there, too. I want this belt, you know. And then and he was, like, even more concerned about what Norvell had just said in the personality profile. He heard what he had to say. And he goes, what's the story with Sweet Brown Sugar and Norvell Austin, man? So there's a lot going on at this point.
All right, so who was in the TV match of that segment?
Well, the 6'10", 430-pound Plowboy Frazier.
Whoa. Dude,
wow. I mean, you know, you got a guy like that, you can't leave him off TV. I mean, he's only been on for one time, and he's only his second week, so I think the fans were more amazed with his size this time than the week before on his first week there. I mean, it didn't take long for him, boy, to use his immense weight. Mm-hmm. He was so big to dominate his opponent, and then he squashed him. I mean, I guess that's a good way of putting it. He basically, you know, slammed him and ran to the ropes and came back and put that 430 pounds in his face. It was like a it's like squashing a bug with your foot, man.
Wow.
So, gosh, it was sitting watching it in the dressing room. It's like, my God, that guy's not going to get up. So, you know, and there was no way that Plowboy was pretty, but boy, he was a sure dangerous looking man, dude, when it came to throwing around all that weight.
So not a pretty man, evidently. All right. To me, that, I think the real key there was word of mouth. Word of mouth got around about, have you guys seen this? Did you see last week with this gigantic 6'10", 800 pounds? I know 400 pounds. All right. But to me, that's truly amazing how big this guy really was. All right. We're at the last TV segment. So set that one up for us.
Well, the Big C had requested, since Southeastern was finally going to allow somebody to have a bull rope match, that he wanted to bring his big Texan out on the beginning of this, the last match, Ron Bass, and give everybody a little demonstration about the danger of a bull rope match, that type of match. So they arrived out there on the set, and Big C had brought a large apple, and he laid it on the desk in front of the set, and first they demonstrated how the rope was connected to each guy's wrist. And then and how they could not remove the rope once it was connected there. They had to have help to get it off. They explained how the only way to win was by hurting your opponent so badly that you could drag him around the ring and touch all four turnbuckles two times. You had to go around twice to be able to win the match. And then they talked about the giant steel cowbell, which is attached in the middle of the rope.
Mm-hmm.
That cowbell was probably, I'd say, 8 inches tall and, the 3-4 inches across. So at the end of the demonstration then, so Bass took the bell and that apple's still laying there. They had brought it for a purpose. And he raised that big old bell up, and I mean, he slammed it down on that apple. Was laying on the desk. We chopped that apple in half. It sent one of the pieces flying off the desk and across the studio floor. It's like, wow. Seeing the effect of that, the TV studio audience, they screamed like, whoa, gee, wow. So Bass and Big C, they just laughed about it. And Bass says, this is what's going to happen to Bob Armstrong's head.
Okay, so that's I've seen a couple of those matches. Now you got the Ronco apple chopper. All right, that kind of match was totally sadistic. So how about the last TV match?
Well, in that match was Bob Armstrong. Bob came out, and the fans always, they were crazy about Bob anyway, so Charlie didn't ask the Big C and Bass on this occasion if he'd like to stay, and Bob just went straight to the ring, but he didn't ask him about making any comments on this one like he had done two times earlier in the show. But as soon as Big C saw that Bob Armstrong was in the last match, well, he sat down at the set with Charlie. He invited himself, and Bass stood behind him with the bull rope, right? So fans always loved Bob Armstrong, man, and they exploded. They were crazy about it. As soon as he entered the ring, they were on their feet. And he was on fire as always, man, and taking care of business. I mean, Bob never went in the ring and had a slow match. He was always on fire, especially on TV. And pretty quickly, he did a job on his opponent, and he put the guy in his sleeper hold. Well, as soon as he hooked the sleeper hold, he had his back turned to the set. Bass took off for the ring with the bull rope. And Big C followed along behind him, but Bass got there first. So Bob saw him coming, and when he bent over to come through the ropes, Bob kicked him in the head, and he reached down and grabbed the bull rope, and he wrapped it around Bass's throat. And boy, the studio crowd was going crazy. So all of a sudden, Randy Rose and Dr. Bill Irwin, and Big C's right there, well, they came running out of the dressing room, and they wanted to get a piece of the action. There's just Bob in there and all those guys. So Rob and I, we left, and we caught them before they got into the ring. And we stopped that, and then the Big C was trying to get Bob off of Bass. He couldn't get Bob to let Bass out of the bull rope. And then once he finally did, all the heels headed for the dressing room, and that studio was electric, man.
That is a TV show right there, a little bit of everything. All right, so what happened the next week as you take us to the arenas?
Well, Plowboy Frazier got what you can imagine was a convincing win over a much smaller Roy Lee Welch. I mean, that was a real big mismatch, but you had to have somebody to wrestle Frazier. So poor Roy got the shot. So in a no time limit match where there must be a winner this time, it's going to be Jerry Stubbs against Norvell Austin. And the winner of this was definitely going to get a shot at the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion the next week. And Jerry Stubbs ended up winning that match. The championship match with Tony Charles and Sweet Brown Sugar for the United States Junior title was an absolute shock for everybody. I mean, Norvell Austin, at the beginning of the match, as soon as Brown Sugar got into the ring, Norvell Austin came down to the ring. And before the match started, he got in the ring, and Sweet Brown Sugar got out and went back to the dressing room. Left the ring and went to the dressing room. And so Norvell stayed there, and he got the microphone, and he made his little speech about, this guy, I hate this guy. Everybody was by this point, what is this guy all about? So Norvell finally had his, he wasn't going to come back. Brown Sugar wasn't going to come back to the ring until Norvell left. And Norvell got out of the ring and went to the dressing room. So finally the match started between Brown Sugar and Tony Charles. And the match wasn't so sweet. Brown Sugar was a great worker. And he started off the match as a babyface, which he had been his entire career. Now this is his first heel match in his career. He'd done interviews, but he had never worked in this as a heel before. And I watched this. I wanted to see how good this guy was because he was a great worker. But he blew us all away. And he went out there. He had clean breaks every time him and Tony Charles got in the ropes. And he used his speed. He was a very good wrestler. And he was telling a real story here. And you could tell by watching the match that Tony was impressed. Wow, he's like, son of a gun, this guy can wrestle. So toward the end of the match, kind of basically out of nowhere, Brown Sugar started, got Charles down, and he, he, He somehow got this about 2 foot long little piece of rope, like a clothesline rope. And he had it hidden in his tights, and he started choking Tony Charles with that rope. And the referee never could find the rope. He was really good at hiding it. You couldn't see the rope. And, then all of a sudden he would take the rope and stuff it in the back of his trunks when the referee got close to finding it.
Wow.
So he was getting some tremendous heat in the match. I mean, fans had not seen this before. The guy, they didn't know nothing about him. All of a sudden, he starts out as a babyface. Now he's turned into a heel, and he's trying to choke Tony Charles into submission, basically. So Tony kept getting weaker and weaker during the match. And this went on for probably 10 minutes where he'd get the rope around his neck. Then he'd manage to get it off. He'd hide it in the back of his trunks. And so at the end of the match, he kind of magically got the rope around Tony's neck while he was behind him. So he looked like he had a sleeper hold, but he was actually choking Charles out with a rope. So when the ref was checking Tony to see if he was asleep, Brown Sugar took the rope out, slid it, and while the referee's focused on Tony, he slides the rope in the back of his tights again. And the crowd was going crazy, man. They're trying to tell the referee what was happening here. And the ref raised Tony's hand three times and hand drops three times. And wow, here comes Norvell Austin down to the ring. Now, the referee at this point, Tony's lost. He's been put to sleep, right, so far as the referee knows. So the referee rang the bell, and he raised Brown Sugar's hand in victory, and the crowd went crazy with boos. I mean, they were like, whoa, what in the heck is this? So Norvell got in the ring just about the time that the referee had already rang the bell. And he got the belt, and he was giving it to Brown Sugar. And when Brown Sugar turned his back to Norvell, Norvell knew where the rope was. He had watched. He'd stood back there and watched what happened. And he just reached in the back of his tights and pulled out the rope and handed it to the referee. And the referee grabbed the rope, and, you know, and he looked at, you know, Brown Sugar, and he's like, what in the heck is this? And, you know, then Brown Sugar, you know, he was caught. And so a referee rang the bell again. He grabbed the belt away from Brown Sugar and he laid it on the back of Tony Charles. Tony was still on the mat. He hadn't even gotten up yet. And, and then he raised Tony's hand. And it still fell to the mat. He was still out.
Wow.
So the building popped. And wow, boy, then the fight started between Norvell and Brown Sugar. Wow, they fought out onto the floor and all the way back to Brown Sugar's dressing room. It was crazy. Building was going nuts.
That was unbelievably well done. I have never heard or seen a finish like that. That sounds like the opening of Pandora's box, no doubt. All right, so I bet Sweet Brown Sugar was over in one night.
Yeah, I'd say he was. Yes, he definitely was, man. You know, and the next week, we were going to top that one. So Mongolian Stomper, managed by the Big C, he won his title match against Charlie Cook. And the loser of the Fall Leaves Southeastern Tag Team match, Rob and I, we beat Dr. Bill Irwin. And Dr. Bill was the fourth wrestler gone in loser leave matches in 4 weeks' time. We had a lot of guys going and we had a lot of guys coming. And in the bull rope match, both men were bleeding badly. I mean, you couldn't have one of those matches without, being a lot of blood. And Bob and Bass down and Bob had Bass down and he pulled him around the ring one time, touched all four turnbuckles and one time around. And he was started for the second round and Big C jumped up on the apron. And Bob just reached over and grabbed him and he flying married him over the top rope. But Bass was laying down underneath his feet, and the referee was checking on Bass, and he never saw Big C coming flying over on top of him, man. Big C came right down on the referee. Referee went down. Bass was down. Big C, the Mongolian Stomper, then out of nowhere, you know, what do you, I'm sure Stomper's watching this match. Wow, why not? And so he came to the ring. Referee's down. He don't know what's going on at this point. He jumped in the ring. Bob's back working on Bass, and he nailed Bob from behind. And then he took the bell, not the rope part. He took the actual bell, and he nailed Bob with that bell.
Ooh.
And you could hear that bell ring like it was a chime off of a, I don't know what. Hard to explain that he hit somebody that hard with a bell. And so then Big C, he reached down, got Big C on him, and threw him over his shoulder, and he went back to the dressing room. So by this point, Bass is recovering. And so Bob's laying there, and he'd already been bleeding. Now he's knocked unconscious. And so he just pulled Bob around the ring twice, hurts all the turnbuckles, and was declared the winner.
Wow. All right, a side note. I got to ask you about Big C, which we know is Don Carson. Was he still wearing a mask?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. All right. Yeah, he was still acting like he wasn't Don Carson. Yeah.
He's not Don Carson, of course. All right, but he was in a managerial role. Was he no longer wrestling at the time?
No, very rarely. And we're going to get into some of that pretty soon here. You know, he's going to have to end up in the ring, but at this point, he's pretty much managing champions.
I saw him wrestle many times, and even though he was never the good guy, he was always the heel. I always thought, man, this guy was really good. All right, that's a great night of wrestling. All right, what was the attendance? Set up the attendance for the three major markets that got this same card.
Montgomery had 4,500 again. It's the same crowd as it had the week before. These buildings are almost all full. Dothan was 100 more people than it had the week before. 5,200 people in Dothan, which is a packed farm center. And Mobile turned them away again. It'd been turning away crowds now for about 6 weeks in a row. Every week, building only hold 5,600, and that's what the crowd was, 5,600.
Wow. Did you ever get pushback on the Dothan crowd in the Houston County Farm Center back in the day?
You mean about
with the fire marshal?
Fire marshals?
Yeah.
No. I mean, it was really, you know, that was you had certain arenas, Mobile as an example, fire marshals were there every week because they knew it was going to be full.
Yeah,
but you didn't get that. You know, every city had its own different way of doing business as far as the buildings were concerned. But Mobile was very strict about it. Dothan, you could pack them in there, man.
That's awesome. All right, so I tell you, this has really been a great ride, Stud, and it's not over. We are going to have time for a learning tree this week. This is one you found that you want to do today. It is concerning something I think we talked about today, too. One person is asking a question, and the other person answers it. So Tom Duffy asked, Ron, do you think Barnett and company didn't want to pay your talent, or did they just have their chosen group and did not have confidence in the talent that you had when you owned the territory?
Yeah, which is a great question, you know, and what's amazing here is that I had another guy that basically about the same time I got this question sends me the answer to this question, right? So I'm going to start with the question, which you just read from Mr. Duffy. And for the first time, Dave, I got another fan of the many knowledgeable fans we have out there, man. It's pretty amazing. And this guy's name William Arends, and he basically gives the response. The answer is Mr. Duffy's question. So William's answer to Tom's question is, here's what William Arends had to say. He said, Barnett brought in some big names, but the Knoxville fans didn't know any of them. So it didn't mean much to the fans. And what Barnett should have done is he should have kept most of Ron's roster that he had in place in 1979, and then slowly bring in his own guys. I can tell you, Dave, how much these two comments, I can't even, explain how much I love these comments from these fans, these two fans. For years, I've been doing these shows and offering my little bit of knowledge that I have about the sport. And these two fans here, they make me realize some of it's rubbing off on the fans. And I want to thank both of these guys for their input on this, because I spoke a little bit earlier in this show about Barnett and how he was feeling and how his ego was and all this. And wow, what great explanations. The great question, and it's a great answer to you're certainly right about that, Mr. Renz. They should have kept my people and then slowly bring in his own. And that's where they made a critical mistake when they bought that territory, and they should have done it that way, and they didn't.
Hey, that's another reason I love these studcasts. And I got to say, it's another reason, if you're not on the social media with Ron, whether it's on Twitter or X, now known as X, or Facebook, and you got a couple of spots on Facebook, the community-minded way that wrestling fans go about it, and like you said, a wrestling fan actually answered the question of another fan, and you have that happen quite often. Discussions go back and forth. I think that is so cool. All right, there's so much history in each one of these studcasts, and you consistently get such great questions and answers from fans all over the world, and that's how it should be. All right, so where do we ride in the next studcast, Stud?
Well, we're not going to be visiting Knoxville with the All-Stars anymore, you know, the Knoxville 5 card next week, because obviously there is no more All-Star Wrestling. They had pulled out of Knoxville, and the war was officially over. After one solid year, almost exactly a solid year, the war finally ended. Southeastern Knoxville was not even having their weekly matches next week. So we won't have anything to talk about in Knoxville that week, because Knoxville was not doing really well. And the following week, Barnett had Harley Race coming in to defend the world championship against Mr. Wrestling number 2. So he just killed the matches for the week before that, thinking that if I don't run a match the Friday before the big championship, it'll make my championship bigger. So maybe it's another potential mistake that Barnett was making with that decision. So 2 weeks later, we're going to be talking about 2 weeks from now about Harley coming in, defending his title against Mr. Wrestling number 2. And we're going to join them. We'll join them and have that whole card, and we'll talk about that 2 weeks from now. So next week, we're going to, however, we'll be discussing another hidden history secret, and we'll be covering the return of the Hall of Fame Mystery Man, a guy that had been gone from the territory for more than 2 months at this point. He suffered back-to-back concussions in 2 weeks in a row, and he's going to be coming back for revenge. He's returning for revenge. We'll announce who that's going to be next week. And we'll also be diving into the growing popularity of this junior heavyweight class of Southeastern wrestlers with another shocker next week. Another finish next week, Dave, that I think is going to be more powerful than this one that we had in this week. And hopefully we'll also have another learning tree question as well.
Oh, that's so cool. All right, listen, folks, as we mentioned moments ago, you can find Ron on Facebook, of course, at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like, follow him there, automatically become friends with a living legend. Twitter or X, it's the same deal. Ron Fuller Welch, follow him there too, and be connected with the wrestling community that follows the Tennessee Stud. Check out the fantastic website, TNStud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. Shop the stud store, where you can get 43 super studcast, 4 different 8x10 photos, the thrilling Lion novel Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirts still on sale, only $15.99, all with free shipping. subscribe to the YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind. When you go to YouTube, it's the first thing that comes up when you start putting in the word Southeastern. You'll find hundreds of hours of classic old school wrestling entertainment. If that's what you're looking for, boom, that's home plate for it. 429 total videos. I know because I've been through these doing research with Ron. The last 133 Studcast, 16 Ask the Stud shows, and 115 short rides with the stud. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic stud stories about worldwide stars. 23 Studcast archive stories, 23 Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and so much more. YouTube, Southeastern Rewind. It is the best deal in wrestling. All right. Any final comments, Stud?
Well, I just want to thank everybody, man, for joining us today. Hopefully you enjoyed it. If you did, please tell your friends about us. Please take care of yourself, everybody out there, and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.